Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour. This is for June 4th, 2016, 2020. Where did that was just kind of rolled off my tongue there, 2016. Maybe I had a bad dream last night. That's possible. Anyway, try and get back to reality here. SpaceX, congratulations to Elon Musk and company. A successful launch. Now, I was going to announce this last week, and I was waiting and waiting. And, you know, of course, then I thought, okay, well, I'll just announce this week. A successful, apparently 100%, everything went perfect launch. The first launch since apparently about 2011. That was back in the, I think, the end of the space shuttle days when we had the last launch of humans from American soil. Now, look at that, and you got to ask yourself, what are we paying NASA for? We have an independent guy come along here that does, you know, out of his own pocket, but we're talking competing against the government space agency that has bazillions of dollars, billions and billions and billions. I mean, this is so absolutely absurd, it's just beyond recognition. And why do we keep paying NASA anything? What are they doing? What on earth are they doing? and with our money, with this vast amount of money that's, you know, and some private guy is coming along, taking their people into space. You know, I mean, this is just beyond absurd, beyond absurd. Anyway, I just wanted to mention, too, if you had not seen my drawings, the artist renditions of my space launch system that was up for about a week last week. And I put those up there because of the show that I did with Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on the 26th. And if you haven't heard that interview, I think you should go listen to it. It's the 26th of May for the 2 hours, 2 hour show. Very, very good interview. I had some good caller calling in, asking some good questions. So anyway, and then, of course, I'm always on with John Moore every Wednesday morning. And also, I've had to turn down a lot of radio interview requests recently. Not a lot, but some. Just I'm overwhelmed. I'm so busy lately with so many things going on and just trying to maintain all of the different things that are going on here. It's just incredible. So, but the space launch system is worth looking at. It's a very interesting idea. Something very different along the same line as it's along the same runway to launch, runway to orbit. That's a concept that's very old, but there's many variations on that, and mine is a little bit different. All of the drawings are not available on my webpage, just the launch vehicle and how the central hotel, as I call it, would launch out of this. Okay, so this week, over the past week, the European Space Agency flew through the tail of Comet Atlas. Now, Atlas gained some fame here because, and there was some kind of goofiness going around, some of that typically happens whenever there's a comet. The disinformation trolls got to get in there and muck it up so that you know, and make light of it, let's put it that way, through troll-type activities on the Internet. But anyway, the European Space Agency just so happened that they had a spacecraft in that area. Gee, isn't that convenient? And this spacecraft was supposed to go online June 15th and start monitoring solar conditions. But it just happened to be in a place where it could go through the tail of this comet, so they did that. And there's no information that's come out, not a shred of information, certainly nothing I've seen. There was some hype before this pass through of a comet tail. There was some hype. There was some, you know, some articles published which were gee whiz, kind of talked about what could happen. And the European Space Agency made it sound like, wow, we're ready for any kind of data, no matter what. But then I noticed that NASA's got their little paw in this too. So as long as NASA's got a hand in it, then I guarantee you there's not going to be any real science that's coming out to you, the public. So I wish I had something to report, but there's nothing to report. There's no information that they've released on this as of yet. Maybe they will this evening. Sometimes they wait till after my show because they know I'm going to jump all over it and inform you. And by next week, there'll be other things going on. Also want to announce that I have a new logo, and sometimes these are things that happen in the background. And but the JMCC Wing company of it is a registered Delaware LLC corporation. And for a long time, I've had a logo. It wasn't the best logo. So anyway, I had some people recommend that I go out and get a new logo. So I did. And getting a logo is kind of interesting because you want the logo to represent your company and give a message. Now, there's two types of logos. You have the Mercedes-Benz or the Audi or the say Chevrolet, just that shape of the logo is all you need to look at, and you know Mercedes-Benz is that little three-pointed kind of like star in the middle of a circle, and that indicates high quality. When you see that, you kind of think, you know, Mercedes-Benz, high-end auto, high-end quality, luxury interior, all of those things come to mind. That's because they have name recognition and decades, maybe a century worth of name recognition and product recognition as being high quality. But I don't have that time, and so my logo has to be more informative. It has to be more literal. It has to be show exactly what's going on. So one of these days I'll post it up on my webpage. And so there's a number of companies that are right now involved in what I'm selling. JMCC water filters, of course, that deals with all the water filter products. The JMCC Wing was a company that I had to form because of the, there's patents involved, trademarks, internet registrations, insurance, every form of type of, the things that go along with a normal business. And, of course, this is a product business. It's not a service. It's not an internet information business. There's a product here. It's a very complicated product with a lot of innovative design work, not only in what you see in the wing part of it, but also in the electronics. Very new concepts that nobody has ever done before. High voltage, low, small wire size, all of the things that go along with us, too numerous to mention on the air. But anyway, so the JMCC Wing is a separate company, and that's where the new logo is coming from, representing JMCC Wing. And then there's the JMCC Science, the J. McGinney Science. And the short URL is jmccsci.com. So it's kind of like these things are growing. And then there's the other one, too, which just came out to the public, at least. It's been there for a long time, but the JMCC, the Space Launch System. So that's something that's kind of branching out of this also. And that launch system was there actually quite a while ago. It was there back in whenever my Diamond Principle book came out. That entire concept of runway to launch with the tubes and the independent space station, etc., very low cost, a very low fuel consumption to orbit. And that's because you're using wings of an airplane, basically a jetliner size of airplane, and capable of launching a 200-foot tube into outer space that's a completely prefabricated hotel with 10 units in each tube. I'm talking about the logo here for the JMCC Wing. So like I said, I'll be posting that, and it's kind of interesting. A lot of lot of kind of nitpicky little work went into getting that logo up to where it is today. And it's kind of fun. As also, when I was working with the artist that did the renditions of the launch system, that was something, a back and forth, effort with many iterations. And so it's kind of interesting working with somebody who's a graphic artist, and I'm putting scientific concepts or engineering concepts into representing them. And so, you know, it's kind of fun to see that the way people come back with something, and it's totally different than what I thought I told them to do. And no, do this. This is, and then they change it, you know, and it's a lot of back and forth work to get the final product the way I envision it. Okay, so anyway, that's something that, just watch my webpage, and that'll come popping up very soon. My webpage is going to take a little bit of a turn here coming into the future, and I'm trying to update the jmccwing.com webpage, and that's something because there's a lot of activity going on in the background. So in a sense, I have to keep some of these things separate, because you can imagine people coming in, say, that heard me on a radio show and they're interested in the wing generator. Well, you know, that's what they're interested in, and so I have to focus web pages for what their focus is. And so that's why I have a separate page for JMCC water filters. I have a separate page for JMCC wing. And so a lot of this requires updating and constant management, so to speak, just for those few things. So I try and do this in the background, but these little items sometimes, they're all things that are necessary. So I try and spend as little amount of time on those as I can, but still do a good job. So just a mention about the grow towers on my webpage. People are buying these, and this is something I did as kind of because I wanted to do it. I thought it was important. I thought it was important for people to have access to the ability to grow vegetables, high-quality vegetables, right at your own home. And, so most people can't have a garden, or if they do, you know, it's just a very small one maybe. Very few people have the ability to grow enough food where you can actually pick it fresh. And even an outside garden is only viable for maybe 4 months of the year in most places, especially in the United States. It's a temperate climate. And then, of course, fall and winter come, and unless you have a greenhouse, then you're really out of luck. You have to depend on those few summer months to grow a garden. So the grow towers are very clean, for number one. They are very, very clean. They don't have a lot of mess. There's no dirt. They come in a kit form, so you get everything you need, including the seeds, the pumps, the tubes, the instructions on how to do this. And then, but the interesting thing is that people are coming right now to buy commercial systems. And so some will start small, get a smaller system to get their knowledge up on how these things work and how much time it takes and things like that. But it's a viable business, because what happens is you're producing such high quality food, if you're doing it for commercial sake, that you can sell it to gourmet restaurants. It's the high end of products. It's much better than you're going to get if you go to the grocery store, even if you go to a nice grocery store and go to the produce section. A lot of them have very nice looking produce, and it's organic, it says, but really it's not organic. It's there's typically a GMO. They're GMO products, so they're genetically modified fruits and vegetables and berries, whatever else you're buying there. But also, if it comes across the state line, 99% of the time it has to be sprayed with something to get it to market, or it gets to the counter and the grocer and they spray it with something. Somewhere, even those organic items are being sprayed. So the grow tower is a way for you to grow really high-quality, organic, non-GMO crops right in your own house. And, you know, a tomato plant will produce tomatoes for 3 months. the more you pick, the more that will grow. So anyway, just another quick note. Of course, most of you probably know by now, I have a new book out. This book was timely. I would have rather waited a month or two to release this, but the timing was such that the 30th anniversary of the discover of the true discovery of the comet Hale-Bopp was in 1990, so that's 30 years ago, and right at the end of May. So that's why this book came out. It's called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And it goes, I released a DVD, e-DVD in 2015, and I called that the 20th anniversary of the discovery of Hale-Bopp, Harrington Expedition, Planet X Update. And that was the 20th anniversary of the official, the public discovery of Hale-Bopp. But it was literally discovered 5 years earlier by Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory under the contract from NASA called Search for Planet X. And so I go through this whole history because I lived through this whole history. And literally, there's nobody else that understands this like I do. I was on Art Bell's show. I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show with George Norrie during this time also, leading up to 2003. Remember, the world was supposed to end on May 15th, 2003, from a Planet X object, which turned out to be a big full moon. That was a big disinformation campaign. And so anyway, I'm just not going to go through it here, but a massive amount of detail to put this history into perspective. And so I highly recommend that you read this from a historical perspective, but then also you have to understand my work and how this weaves into this, you know, starting from my years at Cornell, what I call the Cornell years, 1979 to 81, with the production of my, you know, the papers that came out of my theoretical work, and then on through the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and now we're going into the next decade, you know, literally 40 years and counting from where my work has been basically central to all of this that was going on. And so I was nose to nose with the people, you know, inside of the Goddard Space Flight Center or Los Alamos National Laboratories, or the JPL people, or Cornell, which was a sanctuary for a lot of NASA scientists, not the least of which was Carl Sagan. Oh my goodness. I mean, the amount of basically history here is just absolutely incredible. So this is more of a history book. It's not a projection of anything to come, and I do not have any projections of anything to come. That's hopefully will be by the wayside. And then I explain how the timing of this is very important, how they selected certain dates where there was supposed to be major Planet X events, and of course there wasn't. But why did they pick those dates over other dates? All of this history comes out. So on my webpage, and it's only $9.95. I mean, this is an incredible deal. Or you can get it free with $150 worth of purchase of any other products on the webpage. So that's on the webpage. But in another week or so, I'll be taking that down and dedicating my webpage to the wind system, to the water systems, and solutions of world problems. Also, just want to remind you that the factory for the JMCC water filters is still operating. We don't have any stainless steel containers. Nobody does. But the filter elements, that's what most people are after, the filter elements. And if you don't have a container, say you don't have any container at all, there's a couple options. You can buy the above sink or the below sink models, the pressurized models. But if you insist on having a gravity fed water filter, you can go out and buy locally 2.5 gallon or 5 gallon plastic, food grade plastic containers with the lids, and then just drill some holes put in the filter elements and the spigot, and you've got yourself a water filter. And I've been using those for years, and they're excellent. They provide very good water. But those are the two options, either buy the above or below sink models, which are in stock, or get yourself a couple food-grade plastic containers, drill some holes, and I can tell you how to do that. But then but the majority of people already have a container, and I would suggest stocking up on filter elements, because I'll tell you something. I think that this chaos that's going on is just the beginning. They're not going to let up. The people who want to take over the United States are not going to let up. They don't want things to go back to normal. You see the timing of this. Just as the United States was getting ready to open up, all of a sudden, this black guy in Minnesota gets killed. All of the riots start going all over the country, and we know that these people are being paid. There's hundreds of millions of dollars being paid to people to go in the streets and riot. So, I mean, there's stories of this coming out all over again. So the George Soroses and all of these people are not going to let this slide. This is their big opportunity to take over the U.S. And as I said on John Moore's show yesterday morning, the 2020 election is the prize. I mean, they want to take from the president down to the lowliest little local office, clerk of court or whatever. They want to fill those positions from top to bottom and wall to wall with the liberal candidates that will move the policies. And this is all being paid for. These are people that are going to make money. And I can't believe that I actually see people saying, oh, yeah, they get paid for this. And they'll do that. They will sell their grandma down the river for a couple bucks. And their country, excuse me. But my point in starting to talk about this was I would suggest that you start getting prepared. And one of the things you're going to really need and long term is water filtration. So get stocked up on water filter elements. We are still operating the standard size and the imperial filters. We're a little bit behind on getting the imperials out because most people order them. And so anyway, but the factory is operating. We are going to carry through and continue to operate, and so get your filter elements at the webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, on to tonight's main science topic. I wanted to talk a little bit about the breakup of Comet Atlas that actually happened about a month ago, and then they started seeing these littler comets developing within the coma, within the tail region of Comet Atlas. You started to see other comets developing. So there must be some very healthy electrical interactions going on in that tail region. And I'm anticipating something coming out of the European Space Agency. There have been people, I'll just say that, I'll leave it at that, people communicating with top-ranking members of the European Space Agency. And they are very, very aware of my work. But they're also very aware that NASA is not going to let this thing go, this dirty snowball thing. They want to keep this moving because, well, that's a whole agenda. And part of the agenda, you can learn about why that is in my book, the one that just came out, the Planet X Update 2020, and understand what is the deal here? What is the stopping point? And I've been dealing with this literally for 40 years, but there are people very high in the European Space Agency who are ready to walk. And it's very difficult because, see, NASA has got the big purse. NASA has got the big bucks. And if you want to do science, you better, like, lick the heels, lick the boots of NASA. And so as far as getting, you know, funding, and NASA can just say, well, look, we don't want to do this project over here. And all the scientists, one of the big problems with scientists today is they're like squirrels that forgot to forage. They forgot how to go in the woods and find nuts and berries and eat and live. And the NASA scientists depend 100% on the government funding, and the government funding is all top down. So they have no place to turn. And so their livelihood, they got the house payment, they got the wife, they got the kids going to college, they got their retirement coming up, and it's all dependent on the government. And so if they step out of line or say a word sideways, something that doesn't gel right, they could lose their job. Because, you know, where's a NASA scientist going to get a job? They can't even get a job at McDonald's, even if they wanted to. You know, there's the unemployment. So they're running scared. They're running scared. And in Europe, they depend on 90% of their funding and their ability to get associated with good equipment. They depend on NASA. So this is, it's all exactly what Eisenhower warned us about in the famous speech Eisenhower made when he was leaving office, his farewell speech. He talked about the military-industrial complex, but if you go listen to the whole speech, he spent about the next 20 minutes, he spent about 15 seconds talking about the military-industrial complex, but he spent the next 15 minutes talking, maybe not 15 minutes, but a good healthy chunk of time, a lot more than what he spent on the military-industrial complex, he spent on the university professor system of endowments and funding. And he said that's where the real danger lies, because once you start getting money involved, then you get the control, you get the deception, you get the, you know, people working for money, doing science for money. And that's, he considered to be a very big, major threat to the United States and its future. And we are there now. We're in Eisenhower's predicted world. But back to the idea of flying through the tail of a small comet. It was 1985, about, when a small comet, it was called Giacobini-Zinner. It's a small inner solar system comet, and a group of illustrious NASA Goddard Space Flight Center scientists, they work between Los Alamos and Goddard, decided to take an aging spacecraft called the ISSS-3, International Solar Explorer, it was called, and they were going to move it with a little bit of fuel that was on board. And then they looped it around Venus and got in a gravitational assist. And then they went out towards this comet, Giacobini-Zinner. And so as a result, I wrote a paper. It was called Dynamics of a Small Comet. And it's a perfect paper for what the European Space Agency is experiencing as they go through this comet. And so I guarantee you they are understanding that this is not a dirty snowball. And within the European Space Agency, they already know this because they landed on the nucleus of a comet, 67P. And they landed on the surface of this comet. There was no snow or ice or water of any kind. There was nothing coming off the nucleus. And I talked personally with the head scientist, one of the head scientists on the mission, a woman, and she said that, I said, how close, what was the closest proximity to the nucleus where you actually detected water? And she kind of stumbled a minute, and she knew, I knew what the question to ask, as most reporters don't. Most reporters are just looking for a gee whiz story, they slap it down on paper, they get paid, and they go home and pay for their apartment. I asked the correct questions. The question was, how close was the closest distance from the nucleus of Comet 67P? How close was it that you actually measured water and could actually say there's a water molecule there? And she said 10 kilometers. Within 10 kilometers, that's like 6 miles, within that distance of the nucleus, they detected no water at all. And of course, when the lander landed on the nucleus, there was absolutely no water on the nucleus. What they discovered was kind of a dust. It was made up of organic material. So that means carbon and hydrogen, oxygen and nitrogen, typically, and then some other things possibly mixed in. But those were the main components of this material, this like dust material that was on the surface of this comet. No water, no ice, no snow, nothing coming off. And so, very clearly, this was not a dirty snowball, yet it had a tail. If you look at the comet at a distance, when they landed on the nucleus, there was a tail associated with that comet. And then I asked the woman, the lead scientist from the European Space Agency, I said, what was the closest distance where you got what you would call an abundance of water sufficient to commensurate with the tail material that you might see at a distance? She said 100 kilometers. So the closest that you could actually measure water in the abundance that would be noted in the tail region was 100 kilometers away from the nucleus. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. And so the lead scientist at the Paris Air Show, this was a number of years ago, the summertime Paris Air Show, admitted on camera, very much under his breath, mind you, that, this is the way he said it. He said, I have written a number of papers through, this is the guy talking, he said he had written a number of papers throughout his career of papers dealing with the Dirty Snowball Comet model and making predictions about what comets would be like, etc. And he just looked down and he said, I can say right here that is not correct. That model is, kaput. It's not valid. So anyway, the European Space Agency fully well knows that, number one, the Dirty Snowball Comet model is not correct. They're very familiar with my work. And within the inner ranks there, they're very familiar with my work. And they know for a fact that I am absolutely correct. But they got this little problem because NASA won't let this bone go. They're not going to, like a dog that's got a hold of a bone and, like, say, a big, big ham bone. You got a dog that's chewing on this ham bone. You try and take that bone away from that dog and you're going to have a fight on your hands. It ain't going to happen. That dog is going to guard that bone with its life. And that's what's going on with NASA. The old country western song, that's my story and I'm sticking to it, about this very comical country western song. I'm not going to repeat it here, but that's NASA. So anyway, but what are they going to see as they come into this comet? Well, they're going to see X-rays on the nose side of the comet. And X-rays in comets would have been discovered at my request, because when the spacecraft, which they renamed to ICE, ICEEE, International Cometary Explorer, they renamed it, anticipating an ice ball, because that's what NASA told them. And when they went out there, they were worried about the batteries on this spacecraft that was in the 1980s. They were worried about the batteries being losing their charge and not having enough charge when they get out to the comet encounter. So they had to turn off some of the instrumentation. And what they did is they went to NASA and they said, what instruments are not necessary? And NASA said, well, you can turn off that X-ray detector because this is a snowball, there ain't no X-rays. And I called him up. James Farquhar was the lead scientist on this project. And I called him up and I said, leave the X-ray detector on. And he goes, well, NASA scientists, they're the expert. They told us to turn it off. I said, no, turn it on. I also directed them to fly on the nose side of the comet. And, of course, everybody sees the tail. So they wanted to fly through the tail of the comet. I said, no, the real interesting stuff is out on the sunward side. And, of course, Dirty Snowball Comet model would predict that there's nothing out there to see, absolutely nothing. And so then when I got that response from James Farquhar, the lead scientist on the ICEEE renamed spacecraft, I called up the lead scientist on the X-ray experiment. And I said, look, you guys have been invited to a party, but you're not going to be able to eat any of the cake. You're being left out. You don't have a ticket to get into the party here. And they were very distraught because they, you know, the first spacecraft ever to approach a comet, and they were told that their instrument had to be turned off. And I said, go tell them to turn this on and to look to the nose side of the comet, and you will see X-rays. Well, the spacecraft went through the tail of Giacobini-Zenner. The X-ray detectors were turned off, and this was 1986. It wasn't for another 10 years that NASA accidentally put the Rosat satellite in the direction of a comet Hyakutake and measured X-rays. And that was considered the discovery of the decade of the 1990s, when a whole decade ended in 1999 and they looked back for the scientific discovery of the decade. That was the scientific discovery. But it would have been 10 years earlier if they would have listened to me, and I told them exactly what to do and where to look. But nope, the NASA experts said that there wouldn't be any X-rays on a comet because it's an ice ball, and there certainly couldn't be. So when they finally discovered the X-rays, then they had a problem. How do you theoretically account for X-rays to the 30,000 miles out to the sunward side of a comet that's made out of ice? Oh, my goodness. You know, talk about the morons leading the parade. Just absolutely ineptitude. So then they came up with the idea of something called charge exchange. And only more recently, people have gone back in and analyzed the data and looked at other data sets regarding X-rays and comets. And they came back and they said, no, it was Bremsstrahlung. And that was my prediction, that Bremsstrahlung means in German means breaking X-rays, which means that the charged particles come in, they see an electric field, and they slow down and they generate X-rays. And so it's a broad spectrum of X-rays, not this line, the line spectrum of this charge exchange, what the charge exchange expected. So there was a little teeny bit of that, but that's just due to random interactions of electrons coming in. But in the plasma discharge comet model, you have this electron beam, very intense, coming from the sunward side. And that's why I predicted in my very early papers when I was at Cornell, I predicted that you would find X-rays to the sunward side of the comet nucleus. And that was my signature, by the way, that I said this will be the ultimate thing that decides between my theory and the dirty snowball comet model. But leave it to NASA. Don't let anything stand in your way to accepted theory. And so to this day, they still, this is left in a muddle, but new scientific work has come out showing that, in fact, I was right. And this would have been discovered in 1986. And I'll tell you something, boys and girls, that would have been Nobel Prize winning material, a prediction made years earlier in a published paper stating that there would be X-rays to the sunward side of comets. Then all of a sudden the unexpected opportunity to come with a spacecraft and actually make the in situ measurements, the in location measurements, that would have been worthy of a Nobel Prize. And so I got robbed of that, along with probably 10 other events, easily 10 events that were Nobel Prize worthy. And but this is what they should have the ability to see as they go through this comet. Now, they've already gone through the comet, and there's nothing available. There's not a shred of information available. The other thing they're going to see as they go through this comet tail, and this is, like I say, published in my paper that was published in the 1980s relative to comet Giacobini-Zenner, they're going to see little bundles of current. And so what they're going to do is they're going to find a magnetic field that's pointed up, then pointed down, then pointed up, then pointed down as they pass through the comet tail. And why is that? Because they're approaching a current sheet. It's like a current bundle, really. It's like a little rope of current. And the reason the current sheets are in ropes is because of something called the pinch effect. When there's an electric current, the charged particles moving in the same direction, whether they're electrons or protons moving in the opposite direction, There's a self-induced magnetic field that pulls the current together. It's called the pinch effect. And what happens is the current sheets bundle up into little strings. And back in the Hale-Bopp days, there were pictures provided by a professor of astronomy down in Florida, and he was taking pictures of the comet Hale-Bopp with a filter known as a Swan filter. A Swan filter gives you a doubly ionized hydrogen molecule and a triply ionized oxygen molecule. And so you just see very highly ionized water is what you see. And so when he did that, the structure of Hale-Bopp looked like a Medusa head. And it had as many as 17 different water tails all flailing around at one time. And that also, interestingly enough, is what the ancients referred to when they talk about Venus, the big comet. They could see all of these arms flailing around out there like snakes coming out of the region of the comet nucleus, which was eventually became the planet Venus. So this was a big, big comet, and the ancients saw this. But they talked about the many tails of the comet, and this is all in the literature. This is what Velikovsky was also working on, is the what the ancients had said about these big comets, especially Velikovsky was concentrating on the comet that became the planet Venus. So anyway, on the smaller comets, however, the currents are much lower, but that's what the spacecraft would see. And in fact, that's what the ISEE-3 satellite measured when it passed through the tail of Jacobini's Inner. It would measure a magnetic field in a northern direction, then a magnetic field in the southern direction, then north and south and north and south as it passed through the tail. What it was doing, it was crossing through these regions of magnetic fields surrounding these bundles of current. And of course, in a dirty snowball, this should all be neutral. There should be no electric charge. There should be no electric currents, and there certainly shouldn't be enough to make them bundle with the pinch effect. So anyway, it just, you know, that you can tell if you know what to look for. You could tell by simply passing through the tail of a comet or the nose side, you could tell a lot about the comet and the electrical structure. But of course, that simply didn't happen. And all of that analysis, you know, I watch these people fumbling with this data, and they just, you know, massaged it. They did whatever they had to do to make it be a dirty snowball, you know. One of the more interesting events regarding the passage of Comet Halley was, I have it written up in my book, I think it's the Atlantis to Tesla book, but it's called Fluff, Fluffier, and Fluffiest. It's a three-act play. And it talks about Fred Whipple, who was the proponent of the Dirty Snowball Comet model back in the 50s when Whipple was talking about it. He was talking about the Ice Ball Comet model. So I called it in my papers IBCM, Ice Ball Comet model. But at any rate, they invited him to go visit in the command center when the Giotto spacecraft was arriving. This was the French spacecraft was arriving to the nucleus of Comet Halley, and it was the only comet probe to go in front of Comet Halley, and it was the only one to have a camera. So as it got closer and closer to the nucleus, it's coming in, the nucleus region is getting brighter and brighter. All of a sudden, it looks like this perfectly white, like absolutely brilliant white potato-shaped thing, and Whipple screams out on international camera. He goes, "That's it. That's the nucleus. There's the nucleus," expecting this dirty snowball, you know, but pure white. That's what they were expecting with all of this material coming off of it. And just as he was saying that, the spacecraft broke through the last layers of clouds and observed the darkest, blackest object ever recorded in the history of the space program. basically blacker than coal, absolutely black. And so there was, of course, these people were absolutely stunned. They didn't know what to think because they expected a snowball. And it turns out that the nucleus of Halley's Comet is like the other small comets that have been observed, that they are black and they're hot. They're steaming hot. There's no snow or water. Snow and water could not exist in vacuum on a hot surface. Just not going to happen. So the whole idea was that they could look at something that was exactly the opposite of what they predicted. It was supposed to be pure white, and it was pure black, nothing coming off the nucleus. And then they said, oh, but it's just a little dirtier snowball than what we expected. Absolutely corrupt science, corrupt to the core. That's the only thing you can say. But the European Space Agency now, they're sitting there, and I bet you there's some of them that are listening to this show right now. And they're sitting there going, you know, they know that I'm right about all of this. They don't want to communicate because NASA would certainly find out about it. They would find out about it. And then the European Space Agency would have to face the fact that they would be ostracized, poo-pooed, and chopped from future programs and funding. That would happen immediately. So they would be basically blackballed because they agreed with me. So they have to maintain their position and somehow pretend that, oh, yeah, this is just that snowball. Oh, doggone. And, you know, the x-rays and everything else that's going on there. They're going to have to pretend that they can go along with that and that they've been educated and they have all this scientific content. And then they'll get people to publish papers and life will go on as before. Okay, so another area of the comet that I want to concentrate on would be very interesting because Comet Atlas split up into many pieces. So what do you have? You have kind of an array of pieces, some of them back in the tail region, and this kind of cluster up in the nose region, all of which are discharging the solar capacitor. So out on the nose side of this, you're going to have a concentrated electron beam. And this is the other thing is that some of these pieces that are back in the tail will be getting the electron current as it comes around the front comet nucleuses, and it will be coming into this tail region. So it's very likely, in fact, I would say that almost 100% certain, the spacecraft is going to come very close to the nucleus of one of these pieces of the comet. So they thought they were going to be moving in a safe distance from the nucleus, when in fact there's going to be probably pretty good sized chunks of rock discharging the solar capacitor right in front of the spacecraft. So I'm wondering at this point, what if they lost that spacecraft? What if they thought they were going through a very low density tail of a comet, thinking that it's an ice ball, and end up basically torquing this satellite out of existence before it ever made it to June 15th, which was the actual turn-on date. That was the actual date for starting normal program for the satellite. So that's another possibility, but for sure they're going to come close enough to one of these objects that it's going to send that spacecraft out of control. And that's what happened with the Giotto spacecraft that flew in front of Halley's Comet. When it hit the electron beam that was coming in from the nose side, the electron beam was so intense that all of the magnetometers, the electron detectors, etc., all went off scale. They got really blasted, and it physically jarred the spacecraft, which was gyro-stabilized. That means it's spinning on an axis, and that kept the spacecraft stable. but it got completely thrown off its axis when it got hit by this electron beam. It was a region out in front of the Halley's Comet that, if you looked there, you wouldn't see anything, but that's where the electron beam is coming into the nose side. So that's where the Giotto spacecraft went, and they got thrown out of their off track. Basically, their rotational stability was compromised. And then when they got out the other side, it took them quite a while to recover contact with the spacecraft. They finally did so and realized that something more was going on here than a dirty snowball. But I can guarantee you they are encountering things there that they did not expect, and especially the electrical nature of the comets. They're getting a wealth of data. And so that I would love to be a fly on the wall. I guess that's what I'm saying. I'd love to be the fly on the wall in the command center at the European Space Agency while this satellite is going through the tail of a comet. I would love to watch these people, watch the look on their face as they, under their breath, say, "This ain't no dirty snowball. How do we politically correctly manage this situation?" Because NASA's going to be there hot and heavy to make sure that they maintain the party line. So this is an interesting confrontation because I think, and from information I've gathered, the European Space Agency is ready to break and say, look, we like your money, we like your nice equipment, but we're not willing to go this route anymore. We're not going to lie for you. Because, you know, in a sense, they have a much bigger egg to fry, let's put it this way. They have to look into the future, and as the future looks back on them, scientists in the future are going to go, look, the European Space Agency had all this data. They landed on the nucleus of a comet. There was no snow, water, ice. They took, right at the comet, they took detection measurements of water, and the closest water that they ever detected was 10 kilometers away. They knew this. So the European Space Agency would be called a liar in the history of science. And, I mean, it's just blatant. There's no way around it. They are looking at data that proves unequivocally that, number one, the comets are not dirty snowballs. Number two, my theory is correct. The plasma discharge comet model explains everything they are seeing. And what's it going to look like if they sat on the data, pretended and lied about it to the public? How is that going to make them look in the future? Are they willing to take that hit for some camaraderie or some money or some ability to get at and access equipment today? Are they going to take that and trade that for their future when the public will know for a fact that I'm correct and that they hid information, they absconded with information, they basically played a very corrupt role in science, something that's supposed to be pure and honest, and they were liars. Are they willing to do that, to label themselves as liars to the future generations of people going out hundreds of years and continue with this facade that for one other bizarre psychopathic reason NASA's hanging on to this dirty snowball comet model? Are the Europeans willing to go along with that for temporary gain and then have the entire world look at them as corrupt in an area of science that should be pure science? Astronomy should be something that is next to God in truthfulness, and they're next to the devil in deceptiveness. Are they willing to take that hit and be called that as individual scientists and collectively as the European Space Agency? Are they willing to take that and present that as the future? And that's what they did with the public trust. I'm interested to see if they will come out of this and make a public statement, because they know about my work. They know very well about it. They've known for a very long time, and I know there are people pressing them as we speak to open up and talk about my work and that it is the correct theory for comet behavior and get over this hump, get over this NASA thing. NASA is a thing of the past. I suspect that in a number of years, NASA will simply be a bad page in a short history, brief history of outer space, and they will be a figment of our imaginations like a bad dream. There are serendipitous events, things that just come along that were unexpected, and this is one of them. This is one of those events that nobody really anticipated, not even the European Space Agency. They probably had some thoughts internally, things like that, but this just arrived on the scene where they had this opportunity to pass this spacecraft through the tail of this comet, Comet Atlas. And so could it be that this serendipitous event would be what could be the turning point? Because, I'll be honest with you. I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show the other night, a week ago Tuesday, so the May 26th. And I was received in a very positive light. I think if you don't understand this, just go listen to that show. I was received in a very positive light, which I always have for decades and decades. And going back, a very popular guest going back into the 90s with Art Bell. And my work has been clearly at the center of all of these issues. It's well known internationally. It's well known within the scientific communities. I presented my material, at the inside of Los Alamos National Laboratories, at American Geophysical Union meetings. My work is very well known, and it has been for decades, going back to the 1979-81 era at Cornell, et cetera. So it's really time for this to just break open and give me the respect and due and move on. Just move on, because how many times can you repeat this, that NASA is holding back and because of psychopathic reasons? That's the only thing you can say. And so it's time to turn that corner in history, break this thing open, and so we can move forward and build equipment that's really designed to go out and study comets, not some solar observatory that just happened to be redirected into the tail of a comet. No, it's time to build real spacecraft that will do real studies and go out and that are designed to study comets for what they really are, not a stupid, dirty snowball. My goodness. I'm about out of time here. So remember to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. We have the grow towers, the water filters, the new book, the wing generator, everything. Just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.